Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is The Cheshire Murders. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. Tonight's episode is particularly gruesome and unnerving. So whilst we always advise listener discretion, we add extra emphasis to tonight's episode. My team and I discussed at length as to whether we should even cover this true crime case at all, but ultimately, we felt that it was important to discuss it for a number of reasons. Firstly, we are against censorship of any sort, so we certainly didn't want to start censoring ourselves. Secondly, this case gets little attention in 2025, so we wanted to ensure that this account is kept in the current mindset. This was an absolutely horrific crime, and the victims deserve to be remembered and honoured, and the perpetrators deserve to have the world knowing just what sickening atrocities they committed against an entirely innocent family. This crime is relatively recent in the grand scheme of things. It happened in 2007, so we were surprised it hasn't been discussed more in true crime communities. We are not saying it hasn't been discussed at all, merely that discussion and coverage has been significantly less than we would have expected. That said, we are going to get into the facts and details tonight. So, final warning. Beyond this point, it gets pretty heavy. On the 23rd of July 2007, a pair of home intruders entered the Pettit family home in the town of Cheshire, Connecticut, in the United States. Cheshire is a beautiful and very affluent town in New Haven County, where more than 2/3 of the residents earn more than double the average US annual salary of $67,000 a year. I have heard some people refer to the family as the Pettit family, but the correct pronunciation of their name is Pettit. A small clarification, but an important one to make, I think. The home invaders were Linda Hayes, who was known as Stephen Hayes at the time, and Joshua Andrew Komisarzewski, and we'll discuss those both in a short while. But let's talk about the Pettit family first. Dr. William A. Pettit and his wife Jennifer Hawke Pettit had 2 daughters, 11-year-old Michaela and 17-year-old Haley. William and Jennifer had been happily married since 1985. They lived together as a family at 300 Sorghum Mill Drive. Jennifer was an oncology nurse at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh when she met William, who, at the time, was in his 3rd year at the University of Pittsburgh as a medical student. Theirs was a whirlwind romance, with them getting married just 9 months after they first met. A lot of folks will say that such quick marriages almost always end in divorce, but theirs was a strong and loving relationship that endured. Both Jennifer and William had gone on to have incredibly successful careers also. Jennifer was a nurse and co-director of the Health Centre at Cheshire Academy, a private boarding school in Cheshire. William was an endocrinologist in Plainville, Massachusetts, his hometown. He was also the medical director of the Joslin Diabetes Center at Connecticut's Central Hospital in New Britain. Haley, the Pettit's eldest daughter, had recently graduated from Miss Porter's private college preparatory school for girls in Farmington. She was a member of the cross-country and basketball teams, as well as being elected the senior leader of the athletic association. Haley also excelled as an honor roll student and won her school's award for exceptional community service for the fundraising work that she did in support of multiple sclerosis. This was a cause close to her heart after her mother had been diagnosed with the disease, and Haley, not one to take bad news laying down, started her own charity to aid MS research, which she named Haley's Hope. In a little over 3 months, Haley was due to attend Dartmouth College, where she intended to follow in her parents' footsteps and study medicine. Michaela, the Pettit's 11-year-old daughter, attended the Chase Collegiate School. She was an avid cook and enjoyed cooking for the whole family whenever she could. She was always positive and smiling, and she was known to be very strong-willed and focused. Much like her older sister, she hoped to progress into the medical field after both of her parents, and Michaela also intended to take over her sister's charity when she left for college and looked to rename it Michaela's Miracle. It's clear from this information that the family were intelligent, hard-working, and high achievers. They were an all-American success story. They'd had a close family bond, and both friends and neighbors all spoke incredibly warmly of the family. They were certainly extremely valued members of their community and adored by many, which makes this account all the more tragic and heartbreaking. Jennifer and Michaela headed to a local Stop and Shop on the evening of July 22nd, 2007. The store was just over a mile away from the family home, and they were intending to pick up ingredients for that evening's dinner, which Michaela was preparing for the family. Now, let's take a look at who the perpetrators are in this series of crimes. They lurk at almost the complete opposite end of the moral and decency scale in comparison to the Pettit family. Linda May Lee, who went by the name Stephen Joseph Hayes at the time of the crimes, and occasionally goes by Linda Hayes today, and her accomplice, Joshua Andrew Komisarzewski, were the two individuals at the center of these awful acts. Hayes was born in Homestead, Florida, and was first convicted for burglary in 1980 at the age of just 16. During the trial for that burglary, Hayes was tried as an adult and had a baptism of fire into the criminal world. In fact, Hayes, who was born in 1964, making her 43 at the time of the crimes, well, she spent most of her life from the age of 16 in and out of prison for relatively petty crimes. Hayes has stated that she was sexually abused as a child by her brothers and sisters, but each of her three brothers and sisters have gone on record to say that she is a sociopath and prolific liar, and that it was her who sexually abused them, convincing their parents that she was the victim too. Hayes spent 2 years in prison between 1980 and 1982 for the burglary and was then released on probation. But within less than 2 months, she was back inside after breaching her parole conditions. This back and forth occurred on more than 30 occasions over the subsequent 24 years. As I stated, spending the great majority of her time under incarceration. Hayes had been a consistent drug abuser for more than 20 years, with rock cocaine being her drug of choice. Hayes has said that she was diagnosed with a gender identity disorder at the age of 16 when she was first imprisoned, but that she was never treated back then. Hayes was again paroled in 2006 following a 2-year prison sentence for criminal damage and theft after she broke into a car to steal a purse. In a strange way, it was this release from prison that began the chain reaction that snowballed into the Cheshire murders. This was because when Hayes was paroled, she was released into the Silliman Halfway House. It was here where she met Josh Komisarzewski. Joshua Komisarzewski, who was originally from Torrington in Litchfield County, Connecticut, was Hayes' co-conspirator in the home invasion and murders. He was 26 years old at the time of the crimes, born in 1980, to a 16-year-old girl who had been impregnated by a mechanic who was just 20, described as barely out of his teens by adoption officials. Commissar Jeffsky's mother had a history of drug abuse and mental illness, and very quickly realised that she was in no position to raise a child. So Joshua was put up for adoption and was soon adopted by Benedict and Jude Komisarzewski. Benedict was the son of theatre director Theodore Komisarzewski and dancer Ernestine Stodel. Benedict and Jude were a wealthy family, so Joshua was adopted into a lot of privilege and wanted for nothing. The Komisarzewskis weren't the most experienced of parents, however, and this was evident when Joshua, as a toddler, was diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder. Oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD for short, is a type of behavioural disorder that occurs in children, whereby they display consistent and extreme levels of uncooperativeness, defiance, and hostility towards acquaintances, family members, and other authority figures. As the Komisarzewskis were highly religious, they refused to allow a doctor or psychiatrist to treat young Joshua for his ODD, believing instead that God would cure their son and take care of things. Joshua was sexually abused as a child, and also burned, tortured, and verbally abused. This wasn't at the hands of his adoptive parents, however, but by his older brother, who was also adopted. In the early 1990s, and before he had just entered his teens, Joshua's younger adopted sister accused him of sexually assaulting her. He was convicted for this, and whilst professing his innocence during the penalty phase of his trial, Joshua's father conceded that he believed that Josh was likely guilty. Komisarzewski committed his first burglary when he was just 14 years old, and his life escalated into one of petty crime and drug abuse from there. At the age of 22, in 2002, Joshua was arrested for burglary and 18 counts of home invasion, which he had committed that year alone. Joshua admitted to his attorneys at the time that stealing from the homes was one thing, but what he enjoyed most about breaking into people's houses was standing in the darkness of their bedrooms while the occupants slept, and just watching them, listening to them breathe. It was the violation of their safe space, being in control and knowing that they were entirely unaware of him watching them from within their own home, that really got Josh off. Josh was sentenced to 9 years in prison for the home invasions, crimes which his adoptive parents simply blamed on a satanic cult for warping his mind with drugs and thoughts of criminality. A satanic cult that quite literally didn't really exist. Joshua was paroled in April 2007, not because of particularly good behaviour while in prison, but purely because the parole board had lost his prison records and they thought, based on nothing more than a hunch, that he was probably rehabilitated. On the evening of July 22nd, while Jennifer and Michaela Pettit were at the local Stop and Shop, Joshua Komisarzewski also happened to be in the store buying cigarettes. He took notice of the mother and daughter and immediately thought they looked wealthy. He smelled a payday. So, without hesitation, he proceeded to follow them home, watching them enter their house to ensure that he had the correct place. Josh Komisarzewski was motivated by money and, sickeningly, a particular interest in Michaela. He knew there were at least three people in the house, so he figured that he couldn't successfully carry out the home invasion without help, so he turned to a trusted friend, Linda Hayes, then Stephen Hayes. According to Hayes, the original plan was to break into the home, tie the family up, and leave them there after they had robbed them of what they had hoped would be a lot of cash. American friends, tell me, is it common for people to keep large amounts of cash in their homes over there? It certainly isn't in the UK. In fact, I actually can't remember the last time that I carried cash, used cash, or even had cash in my possession. I pay for literally everything on card or Apple Pay. So I'm not sure why they thought this family would have huge wads of cash in their home. Reach out and let me know. Anyway, I digress. Shortly afterwards, Hayes sent a text message to Commissar Jeffsky that read, quote,
"I'm chomping at the bit to get started. Man, I need a margarita soon. Are we still on?"
Commissar Jeffsky replied, quote,
"Yes."
Hayes' next text asked,
"Soon or?"
To which Commissar Jeffsky replied,
"I'm putting the kid to bed, man. Hold your horses."
And Hayes finally replied with,
"Dude, the horses want to get loose. LOL.
When Jennifer and Michaela got home from the Stop and Shop, Michaela began preparing dinner for the family. A meal of bruschetta and a pasta dish. Bill had just returned from a day out golfing at his local club, while Hadley had just returned home herself after spending the day at the beach with a number of close friends. The family sat around the dinner table and ate at around 7 p.m. Following this, with time spent watching television as a family, and at approximately 10 p.m, Hayley retired to her room and went to bed, while Jennifer and Michaela spent time together in the master bedroom, where Jennifer watched more television in bed and Michaela read a Harry Potter book. Bill had fallen asleep downstairs on the couch in the sunroom, exhausted after a long day on the golf course. At 3 a.m, all of the family were asleep, and Hayes and Commissar Jeffsky made their move. They discovered an unlocked door to the basement and entered the house. In the basement, Joshua found a baseball bat leaning against a wall and picked it up for what was about to come. The pair crept upstairs and found Bill asleep on the couch. For a short time, Joshua just stared at Bill, watching and listening to him sleep. Then he lashed out and started beating Bill on the head and face with the baseball bat. Naturally, during the attack, Bill woke up, but was unable to fight back due to the volume of blood pouring from his head and into his eyes. Bill was on blood-thinning medication at the time for a heart condition, and this meant that he bled out even faster than normal. Hayes and Commissar Jeffsky managed to tie Bill up, binding his wrists and ankles together with zip ties and demanding he tell them where the safe was. But Bill replied that there was no safe. In the darkness and with blood still pouring into his eyes, Bill said that he couldn't make out the assailants, but just about being able to see two shadowy figures holding a bat whilst the other held a gun. Before Bill would lose consciousness due to blood loss, the last thing he heard was Commissar Jeffsky say to Hayes, quote,
"Dude, if he moves, then put two bullets in him."
What Bill didn't realize or know at the time was that the gun that Hayes had was fake, a plastic children's toy. After Bill passed out, the two headed upstairs to restrain the rest of the family. Hayley was the first one that they came across. They bound her arms and legs together and placed a pillowcase over her head. They also tied her to her bed. Jennifer and Michaela were next and endured the same fate, both being tied at their wrists and ankles and tied to their beds. Commissar Jeffsky carried Michaela from her mother's bedroom and back to her own bedroom, where she was tied to her bed. They then revisited Bill in the basement and placed a pillowcase over his head too, and tied him to a support column. He was still out cold. The pair ransacked the house looking for money and valuables. They were convinced that there had to be cash and high-value items like jewelry in the house, as they were obviously a wealthy family, they thought. But there wasn't. The Pettits just didn't keep any valuables in their home. But during the house being turned upside down, the pair of intruders came across a Bank of America checkbook. This seems quite antiquated in this day and age, having paper records of your finances. But this was back in 2007, I suppose. The checkbook indicated that that particular account contained $30,000, so the pair came up with a plan B on the spot. They decided that they would wait in the house until morning when the banks opened. They would then take Jennifer to the bank and make her cash a check for $15,000, which they would take off with. They very considerately decided to only take half the family's money, as they didn't want to come off as, quote, shitty people. During the wait until dawn, The robbers both repeatedly told Haley, Michaela and Jennifer that no one would get hurt as long as they did what they were told. Hayes stated that he didn't want to harm anyone, he just wanted some of their money. So the family played ball with the pair. Except Bill, of course, who remained unconscious in the basement. Now, while they were waiting for the banks to open, things quickly took a darker twist. Hayes took the Pettit's family car and headed to a nearby petrol station, where he added $10 worth of petrol to the car and also filled up two petrol cans. That's gas to my American friends. Hayes arrived back at the house just as the sun was coming up. They untied Jennifer and coached her on what to say and what not to say whilst at the bank. They also had her telephone Bill's office and informed them that he was sick and wouldn't be coming into work that day. The two didn't want to run the risk of some random person coming to the house to check on the family and spoiling things for them. Jennifer and Hayes jumped into the Pettit's car and drove to the bank while Joshua stayed at the house guarding the two girls. Jennifer was told to comply if she wanted the girls to remain unharmed, so of course she did. Jennifer headed into the bank and requested a check for $15,000 be paid out in cash as per the plan. Hayes waited in the car for her. Jennifer, however, told the bank teller what was happening and begged her to help them. The teller gave her the cash and told Jennifer to head back to the house with her captor and she would call the police, which she did immediately the moment that Jennifer walked out of the bank door. The police responded within minutes, setting up a cordon around the family home and preparing to take action to rescue the family. Meanwhile, back at the house, Bill, who was alone in the basement, had slowly begun to regain consciousness. He struggled and worked his wrist ties to try and break free. Upstairs, further horror would unfold. With 11-year-old Michaela still tied to her bed, Joshua Komisarzewski violently sexually assaulted her. She screamed and cried as he cold-heartedly raped her and recorded the whole thing on his mobile phone. As soon as Linda and Jennifer had returned to the house with the money, Komisarzewski told Hayes what he had done to young Michaela. And he told Hayes that he had to do the same to Jennifer so that they were both even. Hayes didn't hesitate. Did just that on the living room floor, assaulting Jennifer as Komisarzewski looked on. While this was going on, Bill managed to escape his restraints and quietly slipped out of the basement to go and find help. What he didn't know was that after his wife had been violently raped by Hayes, Hayes then strangled her to death on the living room floor. Bill managed to make it to the neighbor's house, where he asked for help. Initially, the neighbors had no idea who he was. They didn't recognize him as he had been beaten so severely. Hayes and Komisarzewski doused Jennifer's lifeless body and several rooms in the house with the petrol that Hayes had purchased. This was clearly premeditated. The pair doused the girls' bedrooms and covered both girls in petrol too. Both were screaming and panicking. Hayes and Komisarzewski started a fire and then fled the house in the Pettit family car, leaving the house and all inside to burn. Haley and Michaela both died of smoke inhalation. Haley had managed to escape her restraints before she died, managing to run from her bedroom but collapsing at the top of the stairs. Her feet and legs were badly burnt when her body was found. Michaela's body was found in her bedroom, still tied up in her bed. Like with her older sister, Michaela's burns likely occurred while she was still alive. The police, who had the house surrounded, immediately spotted the pair trying to flee, and they stopped them just a block away after crashing into a police car which confronted them head on. The home invasion had lasted 7 hours in total. Hayes and Komisarzewski confessed to the murders without much resistance, although each tried to blame the other as being the leader of the home invasion plot. Commissar Jevski also tried to blame William for the murders. He called him a coward for not saving his family, which he easily could have done, according at least to Commissar Jevski's version of events. The authorities didn't believe a word of it, however. They had more than enough evidence against Hayes and Commissar Jevski. William was the only survivor of the brutal attacks and murders. He chose not to return to his medical practice following that horrific night. He contemplated running for Congress as a Republican, but later decided against it. Although he did successfully campaign for the Connecticut General Assembly and served as a state representative. Following that awful night, the family home was demolished and a garden of remembrance was erected in the family's honour on the land where the house once stood. Commissar Jevski was held at the Walker Reception Centre in lieu of a $15 million bond until his trial. His trial began on September the 19th, 2011, and he was convicted on all 17 charges on October the 13th, 2011. These charges included capital murder, murder in the first, first-degree kidnapping, first-degree sexual assault, third-degree burglary, first-degree arson and second-degree assault. On December 9th, 2011, the jury recommended the death penalty for Joshua, Commissar Jevski. Judge John Blue agreed, and on January 27th, 2012, Josh Commissar Jevski was sentenced to death by lethal injection. His sentence would ultimately be reduced to life imprisonment without the chance of parole when the Connecticut Supreme Court vacated the sentence in 2015. Hayes was found guilty on 17 counts related to the Cheshire home invasion, rape and murders on October the 5th, 2010. On November 8th, 2010, the jury also recommended her for execution. Superior Court Judge John Blue also agreed with this recommendation, and on December the 2nd, 2010, Hayes was sentenced to death by lethal injection. Hayes apologised on December the 2nd, 2010, for all of the pain and suffering that she had caused the Pettit family. She also said, quote,
"Death for me will be a welcome relief, and I hope it will bring some peace and comfort to those who I have hurt so much."
Judge John Blue, after laying down the death sentences on Hayes, said, quote,
"This is a terrible sentence, but it is in truth a sentence that you wrote for yourself in flames. Stephen Hayes, may God have mercy on your soul."
Hayes' death sentence was reduced to a life sentence in August 2015 when Connecticut abolished capital punishment. Hayes was a prisoner at the Connecticut Department for Correction. But as of the 16th of August 2016, Hayes and Commissar Jevski were split up and transferred to separate prisons in Pennsylvania to serve out their sentences. Commissar Jevski made the following statement following his sentencing, quote,
"I feel shame, disappointment, and hurt over what I have caused. I will never find peace within. My life will be a continuation of the hurt I caused. The clock is now ticking and I owe a debt I cannot repay."
2 days after his transfer, on August 18th, Commissar Jevski tried unsuccessfully to commit suicide by hanging himself. I leave the final words of this episode to Dr. William Pettit himself, who said the following during the sentencing of the two perpetrators who had killed his whole family.
"Michaela was an 11-year-old little girl tortured and killed in her own bedroom, surrounded by stuffed animals. Haley had a great future ahead of her. She was such a strong and courageous person. And my beloved Jennifer. She helped so many children."
These crimes shocked the state and nation when they happened, and their horrific nature shook the very foundations of the local community of Cheshire. How could monsters do this to an innocent family? Where is the humanity in the world that human beings can do this to other human beings, and children at that? Joshua Commissar Jevski was a father himself. Yet he didn't hesitate to mercilessly torture and abuse an 11-year-old child before burning her alive. Crimes which truly are the definition of evil and cold-blooded. Linda Hayes and Joshua Komisarjevsky will never breathe free air ever again. But even this seems too lenient a punishment. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.